how are we going to make improvements? Where are we going to make those improvements? How long is it going to take us? The only way you're going to do that, you've got to have goals, and then you have to measure them, and you have to hold people accountable.
I am so honored that you took time out of your schedule to be my guest on this Main Hearing podcast by the Finnish Bar Association. Welcome, Deborah.
Oh, thank you very much. It is my pleasure. It's my honor and my privilege to do this.
I'm so happy. This is a bit beyond words, actually, that we're here in this beautiful new Debe Voice office right next to the Hudson River in New York City, my absolute favorite city in the whole world.
Well, first, let me say welcome to my city.
Thank you.
I am a native New Yorker, which most people are able to detect quite easily from my New York accent. But I do love this city, and it's very kind of you to say it's one of your favorite cities as
it
well.
It is.
And you know, I'm biased. I can understand why.
So today we're going to touch upon two large themes that affect the whole global legal profession, and they are DEI issues and attorney well-being in law firms. And Deborah, you are the president of the American Bar Association.
I am.
Which is the largest voluntary organization of lawyers in the world. And one of its goals is to eliminate bias and enhance diversity. And I would like to begin this podcast interview discussing diversity and gender diversity in particular. Why do you think it is crucial in the legal profession?
So, you know, we've seen all of the studies that indicate that when you have diverse teams and diversity of thought, you get a better product. And that is true whether it's in the legal profession, whether it is in business or in all kinds of professions. So we know that that is the case. In the law in particular, there are times and there are issues that have perhaps disparate impact on women. And it is important to have women in leadership roles in the legal profession to be able to speak to those times and to be able to speak to those issues. So it is not a question, when we talk about diversity, of excluding anyone. It's really a question of bringing more people, more thought, more abilities to the conversation to get the best outcome.
Right. Thank you. I'm thinking about the friction, though, that is inherent to collaborating when the teams are diverse. But I suppose that the friction is necessary and worth the outcome.
Yeah, and I, it's interesting that you think of it or say it as friction, and that certainly can be the case, right? We know that with diversity comes diversity of thought, comes diversity of opinions. And in fact, one of the things that we're experiencing here in the U.S. is a lack of understanding and tolerance for diverse views. And that is why, as ABA president, I'm focused this year on what I call the cornerstones of democracy: civics, civility, and collaboration, the three C's. Now, civics for us in the U.S. means civics education. And when I talk to an international audience, I say rather than civics, I might say citizenship,
right,
or civilization. So people understand that concept. Civility, because, and this gets to your point about diversity and the friction, civility, because we have to have a way to be able to have different viewpoints and to express them in a way that's productive and constructive and not destructive. Because what we know is when you're so fixed in your viewpoint, you're not listening and no one listens to you, which then causes more frustration and friction and doesn't lead to the results that one would like to see. So the collaboration piece of the three C's means we really need to be thinking broadly, whether it's in society, whether it's lawyers working with journalists or business leaders or faith leaders to promote civics and civility, or whether it's lawyers working across bar associations, across practices, across diversity,
right,
to be able to again, have the most productive outcome.
So these three C's can definitely be brought into law firms even.
Absolutely.
Although they were now, you were talking about a great grand theme.
Yes.
Of the, but in terms of sort of difficult conversations within law firms, these are super applicable.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. And until this moment, I hadn't thought about the three C's as being really being used in law firms, but it's the same concepts, right? Isn't it? Especially if you're talking global law firms, so citizenship or being able to bring in different viewpoints and civility, which we all know we need to be able to, again, to express yourselves, to have the freedom to express yourself, but to do it in a way that is going to really be productive and not tearing other people down. And the most common example that we often cite in the U.S. is our Supreme Court justices, Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They could not have been further apart philosophically, but they were the best of friends. And they were able to do that because, as Justice Bader Ginsburg said, we never tore down each other. We might have attacked ideas, but we didn't attack each other personally. And I think that that's something, that's a lesson we can all learn from.
Definitely. Thank you. So let's continue.
Yes.
When we see someone who's clearly extremely successful, we sometimes make these automatic assumptions and rely on our system one and think that, oh, she's had it easy, or you're privileged, or you're you have advantage. And sometimes we make great mistakes there. Moreover, I think that sometimes we forget how humane we all are, and we all have our struggles and difficulties, and we need to navigate with them. That's why I think that the path to success and leadership is always very important to share, especially the parts where it hasn't been all too clear what was going to happen. So, Deborah, would you like to share something about your path to leadership and anything that goes around that, like about your background maybe? Did you have high grades or something? How was your path to this point?
I think it's a great notion to really explore people's paths, because you're right. We may look at someone who's successful and make all kinds of assumptions about them. And we do it every day. I do it as well, even though I try not to. So my path was one where, as I say, I grew up in New York, a native New Yorker. My parents were both from the southern part of the country. They were part of what was known as the Great Migration from the South to the North, African American. Both my parents are African American. And they were moved from the South to the North for better opportunities, not necessarily for themselves, but for their children or future children. They were quite young when each of them moved. My father had a sixth grade education. So for those who don't know what that might mean, that's basically elementary school, sort of first level. My mother had what she called some high school. So I am what is known as first generation to graduate from high school, first generation to graduate from college, first generation to graduate from law school and become a professional. And this has shaped me in a way that I feel has been very beneficial. It was not easy because I didn't have role models. I didn't have
people
that
I... question.
Yeah, I didn't have... I didn't know any lawyers growing up. But what I did have is both the hopes and dreams of my parents, who invested in me and invested in my sister. I had the love and support of a community. And in my case, it was my church. You know, the Black church is really prominent in our community. And especially then, you know, if we think about the American Civil Rights Movement, it was really the churches that were supportive. So I was coming up right around that time. And so those different aspects of my life are what has shaped me. Now, once I graduated from law school and I went to the University of Miami in Florida, both undergraduate and law school, and I always say go Canes and throw up the U, but I wanted to return to New York. And it was a very difficult journey because I had gone to school out of New York State. I had not gone to the top law schools at the time. And as we know, in big law in particular, there is a tendency to want to recruit from certain schools and then to give opportunities to people who look like you, who have the same background that you do, especially then. I think it's changed, thankfully, nowadays. But it took me 7 years to get my first job in international law. Now, I wasn't sitting around 7 years not working. I couldn't afford to do that. I did other kinds of things. So I began my career as a legal services or legal aid lawyer, assisting poor people with their legal problems. And that gave me tremendous opportunity because you get thrown in and you've got to manage your cases, you've got to manage your clients, you learn what it is to be a professional. And the work that we do or did has tremendous impact on people. So we're gonna talk about well-being in a little bit, but one of the things that I found is I was getting burnt out because it was very emotional work. But anyway, that was my first job, and then others, all building up to the point where I then became the U.S. representative for the ICC Court of Arbitration, so the U.S. Council for International Business, and that was my first break. And I tell law students in particular and young lawyers this story because I want to encourage them. I want people to understand that if you don't get your dream job right when you graduate from law school, it is not the end of the world. It's just the beginning. You're going to practice law for a very long time. So if you take the long view, then you will have a wonderful career. And I wish everyone could have the kinds of experience and journey that I've had. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
I love that response. Wow. Let's talk about the imbalance.
Yes.
Someone said that no area of the business world is more illogically gender imbalanced than law firms. And I looked at the published data here in the US and found out it's very much similar to what we're seeing in Finland and elsewhere in Europe as well. So every year, top law firms recruit something like 60% female and 40% male law graduates into the practices. But within a couple of years, these female majorities begin to leave. Maybe not legal profession, but they leave law firms. And while law firms have begun to focus more critically on DEI issues, and in particular on increasing the number of women and diverse lawyers within partnership ranks, and there are bright spots, but the progress has remained slow. Why do you think this is?
Yeah, it's something that greater minds than myself have tackled or tried to understand. There are a number of reasons. It's not as simple as saying, well, women leave to have children and they can't balance the work-life balance and the balance of being mothers and caregivers and the work is just too much. That is a simple answer. I don't think it's a complete answer.
Me neither.
It is certainly what we've seen throughout the pandemic in particular did shine a light on how much responsibility women have inside the home as well as outside. But I think that belittles the role that men have played and do play in family dynamics. And we have seen over the years a number of efforts to try and address that, whether it's maternity/paternity leave and in the U.S. Family Leave, Medical Leave Act, and all of those kinds of efforts. So putting aside the kind of standard idea that it's they have children and then they leave. Perhaps we need to be examining the structure in law firms. Is it a structure that makes it difficult for not just women, but certainly women, to maintain? Yesterday, there was a panel of managing partners as part of the ABA International Law Section. And one of the managing partners, I won't say which one, but one of them suggested, as a global firm, maybe we should get rid of the billable hour. Because if we got rid of the billable hour, then there would be other ways that we could measure people and measure success. And that would that, in fact, help to retain people within law firms. I don't know if that's the answer. That could be an element of it. But is there something that we're doing fundamentally with the practice of law that makes it difficult for people to stay? And if that is the case, we really need to figure out what we can do, because even if you don't look at it from a humane perspective, which we should, and a quality of life perspective, which we should, economically, it's not a good model. If you were any other profession where people get, you know, come in and they get the kinds of skills and training, and just when they're at their peak, they leave, you would be examining, why does that happen? We know that everyone that comes into a law firm is not going to become a partner, but there are other avenues besides becoming partner. But if they leave even before that's an opportunity, then it's really wasted talent, it's wasted energy, and it's wasted expense. So we really have to dig in deeper to try and understand, and to try and understand earlier why people are opting out, and why women in particular.
Right. Thank you. I remember reading this one article where one managing partner said something like he doesn't believe in leaning in and these minorities working together in diversity groups within the firms when we're talking about the majority culture, sort of with systemic exclusion. So my question, I suppose, is that if we want to achieve more parity at the top, wouldn't we need the robust support of the majority of the men? It would strike me as key.
Yeah, well, that's you know, the whole notion of allies and allyship, isn't it? That, you know, you cannot achieve parity. You cannot have the kind of equality and systems that we say we want if you don't have the majority supporting it. And, you know, one thing that we know is that it's very hard for people to give up power. But if they can see what's in it for them in the end, then it's less about what you're giving up and more about what you are gaining.
Right.
And again, I just think we need, you know, we've had this paradigm for as long as I've been practicing, which is you sort of come out of law school, go into a big firm and work really hard, and you look up, it used to be 8 years, and it's 10, 12 years later, and whoosh, you're a partner. Well, we know that that's not going to happen for the majority of people. So what else can we do? What other avenues are there to take talented people with skills and be able to give them the kinds of careers that will be satisfying to them? Now, obviously, going in-house is one aspect, and some people go into government and some people go into not-for-profits. What I say is a law degree is never wasted, by the way, because even people who step away from the law, and I've met a lot of people, especially in this year in the ABA, and they go, oh, I'm a reform lawyer. I was like, no, once you're a lawyer, you're always a lawyer.
I agree.
You're just taking that skills and you're going somewhere else and doing something with them. But the law is now a part of you, so we never lose you. We keep you always in the profession. But yes, it is important to have allies, and you have to, as we say here, you not only talk the talk, but you have to walk the walk, right? And that's why you need a foundation. You need to have a common understanding of what are we talking about, how are we defining it, and then how are we going to make improvements? Where are we going to make those improvements? How long is it going to take us? The only way you're going to do that, you've got to have goals, and then you have to measure them, and you have to hold people accountable. You know, whether it's your compensation system or whatever it might be, whatever accountability looks like to you, that needs to be a part of the conversation. And I will tell you, the biggest influence that I've seen so far are in-house counsel and the way that they partner with their outside firms and the kinds of questions that they ask. In the ABA, we have the diversity survey that law firms complete to talk about their diversity efforts and to demonstrate what they're doing. And that is a tool that in-house counsel can use, and they can say to their firms. I see this on the ABA's survey. This is where you sit, and this is where some of my other firms sit. What are we going to do about that? What can we do to enhance the teams that are working on our matters? And we have found that that's a useful thing that we as an ABA can do to contribute to that effort. We can have objective surveys for law firms to complete. The law firms like it because they don't have to complete more than one survey. If everybody's asking them to complete surveys, you can hire somebody just to complete diversity surveys. But here you have it all in one place. And it really is a way to spark those conversations, to have the kinds of measurements that we would like to see.
Okay, I've got a question from a listener of this podcast relating to status quo bias, a strong force, especially when your own financials are in play. So here's the question. Deborah, do you think that concentrating on maximizing law firm profits slows the progress of DEI issues?
No, I don't think they're incompatible at all. That's like a false choice. I think you can be quite profitable and quite diverse. And in fact, I would argue that the more diversity you have, the more likely you are to be profitable, right? Because you bring in people with diverse views on how not only to manage a matter, but how to go out and get business and how to attract and retain young lawyers, how to go out and make the case for your team. So, yeah, I think that they go hand in hand, frankly.
A question about prejudice. So, as we know, we people are uncomfortable acknowledging that we have prejudices. And someone said to me that we should be most worried about law firm partners who swear that they aren't prejudiced at all. Mm-hmm. So what would be your top three how to work against biases?
Wow, top three. Well, I agree with the person who says we should be a little concerned, is the word I would use, with people who say they don't. In my example, when they say they don't see color, I think that is what you would like to think, but we absolutely see color, we see gender, we see nationality, we have traits that we ascribe to people before they open their mouths. You know, if you look at me before I say anything, you know, I'm a woman of a certain age with my hair braided in New York, and you might think all kinds of things. I mean, maybe you'll think I'm a lawyer, maybe you won't think I'm a lawyer, depending on how I'm dressed that day, right? So we all bring that with us. So what can we do about that? Number one, we have to recognize that we do it. And the recognition isn't one and done. It is constant. We need to make a conscious effort to listen to and accommodate differing views. And that can be difficult, especially if someone has a view that is just the polar opposite of what you believe. But I've come to be persuaded that the best thing that we can do when we come across that is to sit and listen and to recognize that there's a human being on the other side of that conversation. Now, it doesn't mean I'm going to agree, but if I don't vilify you as a person, then perhaps I'm able to speak to you, and who knows, I might be able to move you a bit, or you might be able to move me a bit. But we're not going to move if the first thing I think of is you have the opposite view and therefore you're evil. And, you know, and especially when in these days where a lot of us have deeply held views about very personal issues. So I think trying to make a point of listening to other views, differing views, even to the point of seeking it out, which can be very uncomfortable. But I think it's worth it. So I'm not sure if that was two or three. But
that was two.
I'm going to call it. One more, huh? You're real strict.
No, actually, I love the number two, and I got a segue to what we talked about earlier, the three C's.
Yes.
So these uncomfortable discussions,
yes.
Everything. Now
yes.
That,
yes.
So it came to my mind. I'm fine with these two. They were so good.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Apparently, as someone pointed out to me, I like things in threes.
Yeah. That's why I was trying to push for the third.
So that's
yeah, I
yes.
got that.
Normally, I like the threes.
For a long time, Finland has been a very homogeneous country, and consequently, our law firm scene is also very homogeneous. And whatever the reasons may be, when discussing with my colleagues and friends, sometimes overlapping, I found that there is always some struggling with the thought about promoting people based on anything else but performance and especially billable hours. What do you usually say in these discussions from the viewpoint of all the importance of accelerating progress to gender equality?
Yeah, but that presupposes that, you know, that women can't make or meet some of those metrics. I think the better way of thinking about it is, are those the right
metrics right.
for anyone, right? Because that kind of that gets a bit to some of the debates we have in the US about affirmative action.
That's right.
And making accommodations. And then that presupposes that the people to whom you would be applying these standards are lesser.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is the case. Now, you can say you obviously need to have some metrics for evaluating people. That's what we do. The question is, do you also have other aspects that you look at and how do you weight the various aspects of a person so that you get to the full person? And if your metrics are so fixed that what you're seeing over time is that, you know, either no or very few women are able to meet it, then it's a question of, are you shortchanging yourself because you're not getting the best out of all of your people? And if you're only, you know, we've all seen people who will be able to make the quota on hours, but what else do they contribute? So are you building a firm and building a practice that is based on the whole people and the whole of the practice, or is it simply by the numbers?
I have another question from a listener.
Yes.
What would you want to say to a Finnish, mostly white male law firm partner around 40 to 50 years of age? What would be your top three?
Oh, here we go with the three.
Of actions that their firms could take in order to improve retention of women lawyers.
So I think number one would be the same thing that you would do, hopefully, in any instances. You need to talk to the women lawyers to understand what their needs are, what kinds of support that they are requesting, and really listen to them. You know, one of the things we saw early on in the U.S. was that it may not have been overt, but this kind of unconscious bias towards the male lawyer shows up in different kinds of ways. So, you know, the male partner who says, I don't want to travel with a female lawyer because it doesn't how it looks. So I basically travel with a male lawyer. Well, that has an impact on whether that lawyer then gets assigned and then how she
Absolutely.
Progresses. So I think talking to the women lawyers to see what they need and to give them the kind of support that they have identified is one thing that would be paramount. Like that's, and it's almost like that's an easy thing to do. Easy as in to say this is what we're going to do. It may not be so easy to get the honest responses. So then you've got to create a safe space so that the women feel that they are able to give the kind of feedback that would help them to progress. So you got to think about, what does that look like? It's not enough to say, hey, you can come and ask me anything, and then you don't get any response, and then say, well, we tried.
Yeah, exactly. We said that the door is always open.
Right, yeah. Right. So yeah. The second would be to demonstrate by your actions, not just your words, but by your actions, that you are supportive. And I think this is of all, young lawyers in particular. And let me give you an example. During the height of COVID, when we were all working remote, you know, the law firms would say, or partners would say, and I'm not talking about my firm, I'm just saying generally, partners would say, if you're sick, if you have COVID, we don't want you to work. We want you to rest, and we want you to take care of yourself. A great message. And then partners would get COVID, and they'd be working. Right. And so what does that say to the associate? Well, I know you say, you know, I should rest, but I see you pushing through, so I better do it myself.
That's contradictory, right? Messaging.
So it's you really got to demonstrate by your own actions that you are fully supportive of whatever it is, whether it's, you know, people taking the time off that they need and not disturbing them when they're on vacation or on sick time or whatever it might be. And then a third way that that partner, that white male partner, can demonstrate support is the same way you would do with a male associate: staff them on good work, hold them accountable, but don't hold them more accountable. So check your own bias, right? Because, you know, would you react the same if you got this work product or this reaction or whatever it might be from a female lawyer that you would from a male lawyer? And that requires some self-evaluation, but that's really important. And I likened it to this. When I was younger and I was dating, how do I determine what behavior I will accept from, you know, a boyfriend versus anyone else? And I came upon this formula. I will not accept any behavior from a boyfriend that I wouldn't accept from one of my girlfriends or one of my best friends. So if my girlfriends, if I would say to my girlfriends, we're going to the movies, and they didn't show up, I wouldn't take that behavior from her. So why would I take that behavior from a boyfriend? And for me, that was kind of a really guiding principle. And that helped me because, you know, the emotions get in the way. And it's the same thing when you're practicing, and you are, if you're a partner, you are accustomed to working with certain associates. I get it, because they know you, they know your style, they know your voice at a certain point. And so you're tempted to only work with those associates. You have got to break out of that, especially if the only associates that you're working with are male associates. So those are the ways I would say. And I think I came up with three.
Yes, you Yay! Did. Yes, you did. And now we're going to the mental well-being.
Yes.
So you are the co-chair of the International Bar Association's Professional Well-Being Commission.
I am.
Now, we all have seen these reports on substance abuse, depression, burnout, even suicidal thoughts. And many legal employers say they absolutely want to create a culture of well-being in the workplace, and all sorts of programs are installed. But one could argue that many of those approaches only skim the surface and do not address the real thing. So do you have some wise words on how to rethink and encourage attorney well-being in law firms, and any other thoughts on this extremely important issue on so many levels?
Yes. Well, I think the good news is that law firms, the legal profession, has now understood how important this is. So that's the first step, right? Understanding,
yes.
You recognizing you have a problem, understanding the depth of the problem, and now what can we do about it? So, and that is across the board, whether it is in law schools. If we see in law schools in the U.S., there's certainly a push towards mental health and mental well-being. Within the ABA, there are a number of initiatives where we talk about, you know, in some states, removing questions about mental health, which can be an impediment to becoming members of the bar, moving away from punishing lawyers who have a problem with substance abuse or drinking and really moving towards rehabilitation so that people can report. You know, the part of it is there's a stigma or that there is also repercussions from reporting. So I think as a profession, we are certainly moving in the right direction, recognizing the problem and then trying to figure out different ways that we can accommodate people. Most law firms, especially big law firms now, offer, especially in the US, but I think some global firms as well, offer counseling services and the ability for people to step away and not be punished for doing so. Encouraging each other and encouraging people to support their colleagues, support, not report, there's a difference, their colleagues, encouraging their colleagues to get the kind of help that they need. So overall, I think that the profession is moving in the right direction because we now recognize that this is a problem and we need to do something to be supportive of our colleagues.
Do you see what are the biggest challenges in that?
I think the biggest challenge is stigma.
Right.
And whether it's self-imposed, like I don't want to say anything because I don't want people to know, or whether it is now I've said something and everybody knows.
You're right.
Right. So stigma is the biggest problem. And that includes, you know, lawyers feel like we are problem solvers. We solve other people's problems. We're terrible at solving our own, right?
That's right.
And we feel like, you know, there was a time when it was a badge of honor or courage to say I did an all-nighter. I did five all, you know. That was the way that it was. It was
expected. I remember those days.
All-nighters, right?
Oh, of course.
But now we have to change the narrative and say that it is not a sign of being brave to work constantly without a break, without taking time off. And, you know, there was a time when people would brag about, you know, I didn't make any of my kids' soccer games because I was working on this deal. Now that narrative has changed or is changing. I think that that's important. It's the same way when we talked about retaining women and, you know, having maternal leaves and paternal leaves. There was a time when even though it existed, the men didn't take the paternal leaves.
Not even in Finland, but it has changed.
And now that's changed.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so one of the things as leaders that we could and should be doing is saying, why aren't you? Didn't you just have your baby? Why aren't you taking the paternal leave? And in some ways, you know, you can't insist, but really strongly encourage. So we do that. And it's the same thing for our well-being, to encourage people to be able to speak up and then to not punish them and punishment, whether it is
compensation
or whether it's compensation, whether it's not putting them on, you know, when putting them on partner track, all those kinds of things. If we can make sure that we are not doing that, not punishing them in that way, that will send the message.
Great. You love being a lawyer.
I do. Absolutely. I love being a lawyer. It is a profession that has given me everything, literally. When I say everything, I even met my husband because he was a paralegal when I started out in legal services.
Oh, really?
So, you know, and it has given me opportunities I could never have dreamed of as a young girl growing up in Harlem, you know, uptown. So we're all the way downtown on the west side. I grew up all the way uptown, and I didn't think that I would be sitting here talking to you and being a part of this profession and then having the privilege to lead the Bar Association that speaks on behalf of the U.S. profession. Never dreamed of it, but that's what being a lawyer has given to me. So for me, I will always do whatever I can to uphold the profession, to support the profession, and to support lawyers within the profession, especially our young lawyers.
It's time for the very last question then. I visited the Strand bookstore on Broadway yesterday, and I spent almost an hour just browsing the bookshelves, and I finally bought a copy of this tiny yellow book that I think pretty much the whole world knows. It's Hill We Climb by Amanda Gorman. And I would like to recite the famous opening lines. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. Deborah, would you answer that question to me? Where can you find the light when you're thinking ahead about the future of DEI issues in the legal profession?
I find the light literally in the next wave of lawyers and law students that are coming through. They have a determination to make the world more just that I certainly did not possess when I was at their age. When I go around to law schools, I am just blown away. And not just U.S. law schools. I mean, I've been very privileged. Everywhere I go, these students are filled with energy and enthusiasm, and they want to change the world. And I think they will do it.